dieser Folge spreche ich mit Troy Hunt, einem der bekanntesten Cybersecurity-Experten weltweit. Troy ist Microsoft Regional Director und Microsoft Most Valuable Professional, kurz MVP. Zwei Auszeichnungen, die Microsoft nur an weltweit anerkannte unabhängige Fachleute vergibt, die durch außergewöhnliches Fachwissen, Community Engagement und Einfluss hervorstechen. Bekannt wurde er durch Have I Been Pwned, eine Plattform mit über 12 Milliarden geleakten Accounts, die heute von Millionen Menschen und Organisationen wie dem FBI genutzt wird. Wir sprechen über echte Vorfälle, vom gehackten Zahnarzt bis hin zur katastrophalen gescheiterten Disclosure-Prozessen großer Konzerne. Du erfährst, warum viele Unternehmen immer noch völlig unvorbereitet sind, was es mit den Five Stages of Data Breach Grief auf sich hat und warum Vorbereitung wichtiger ist als jede noch so teure Technologie. Wenn du in der IT arbeitest oder Verantwortung für Security trägst, bleib unbedingt dran. Ich wünsche dir viel Spaß. Los geht's.
Five stages of data breach grief. It's like the, you know, the five stages of grief if you've lost someone, you know, it's like anger and denial and everything. The disclosure was terrible. It was absolutely terrible. We are more than three decades into this. It does feel like it's becoming more businesslike. I'm sitting in the dentist. While I'm there, they're realizing that they've been ransomed. That level of preparation is very often missing.
It's so crucial to do that upfront.
It is an interactive experience. So there's lots of stuff in there that is relevant regardless of people's technical capacity.
Troy, thank you very much for finding time for us today. We really appreciate it. It's so great to be sitting down with a person who's been on the front of cybersecurity for many years, launched a remarkable website, and is sharing his knowledge with IT professionals. Troy, could you just tell us briefly a bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. I'm Australian, as you can probably hear. I probably am most well known now for having started what was a little website, which was Have I Been Pwned, nearly 10 years ago, December 2013, so about to the 10th birthday. It became a big website with 12 billion plus records of data. And now I do a combination of running that website. I do a lot of speaking, increasingly in person again, which is nice. I run workshops. I do a lot of stuff increasingly with government and law enforcement with Have I Been Pwned as well, in really cool ways, like the FBI sends us data and things like that. And I mostly just get up each day and don't know what's going to happen, and I work it out as I go.
Thank you very much for this. So I'm sure a part of the audience already know you, but anyway, for these who not, that was a very good intro. So you talked about your workshops, right? So you've been doing workshops about hack yourself first for quite some time. Can you tell us the importance of being proactive and prepared for cybersecurity incidents?
Yeah, so I started doing this workshop in 2015, and I must have done it over 100 times myself, usually in person around the world, and then obviously remote, as we all did a lot of remote things for a while. And my good friend Scott Helm, who's Manchester-based, runs them a lot himself now as well, which is great. So the two of us run these events together. And the concept is very much about, I think the strapline we had for a while was going on the cyber offense, right? So I was like, how do we try and break our own things before someone else does? And it was always intended to be very developer-centric. So most of my security, right, the most fun stuff, I'll give you a really good example. So the most fun stuff was, there was a while there, we don't do it anymore because it got a little bit difficult to in workshops, but there was a while there, one of the modules we had was about taking your mobile device and then proxying it through your PC or your Mac, whatever it is, and then looking at the traffic from your mobile apps. It's a little bit harder now because of TLS and the way there's public key pinning and the way Apple doesn't like you doing interception and so on and so forth. But on one of these occasions, when we did it in, it must have been about 2017, and I was in Norway, and someone in the workshop discovered that they could control the climate control of their Nissan Leaf EV using the app, and then reverse engineered it and figured out how they could do it using the app, which is kind of the idea of the workshop. It's like, let's figure out how these things work, see if we can find something wrong with it. Now, normally that wouldn't be a problem, but the Nissan Leaf used APIs, which is fine. And obviously, in order to invoke the API, you need some sort of a secret, some sort of authorization, some sort of bearer token or something like that. What he discovered is that the secret that was used on the API, so the thing that only he should have, was printed in the car windscreen. So every car has the VIN number printed in the windscreen of the car. So the entire secret was just the VIN number. So we then had to go through this massive disclosure process with NIST, and they handled it terribly. I ended up just going full disclosure a month after, not getting any traction. It made massive news because of car hacking, and they shut everything down offline. And it was just a crazy, crazy story. And it's like, we were just like literally sitting here in a workshop playing around with stuff, and he found it in minutes. I just found that really cool.
This is brilliant. This is great. So since you're teaching young IT professionals and organizations around the world, what are the key gaps or areas that you're seeing that should be filled in order for businesses to be more prepared for possible cybersecurity incidents? What do you think about that?
I think it, for the most part, it is just a lack of preparation. It's really interesting. Running Have I Been Pwned, I do a lot of disclosures. So I speak to a lot of companies in their worst moments, where I'm the guy going, hey, you know, I'm running this website. I'm legitimate. Here's my Wikipedia page. So I think that adds legitimacy. I don't know. You know, I'm not trying to shake you down for money or anything. And it's their worst possible moment because they've just realized that it's a possibly like business ending catastrophic event, you know, in some cases. And it's really interesting to see which organizations handle it really well versus which ones don't. And one of the things that I realized many years ago is that there are organizations out there that treat breach response very much like disaster recovery. So that, yeah, for many organizations, there'll be like an annual disaster recovery exercise. I used to work at Pfizer, and we had two sites in Sydney, and there'd be an annual exercise. It's like, okay, this site's going to die, so can we roll over everything to that site and we can continue? And then if ever it did go down, well, you've practiced it. So the organizations that actually go out and practice things like incident response, organizations that are even prepared for something as simple as how do we email our customers? I had a breach only a few weeks ago where it was some tens of millions, and the company was very receptive. They were very, very good to deal with. But they said, we actually don't know how we're going to email everyone. Like, we just don't have a way of emailing our customers, which kind of sounds crazy until you realize it is actually hard to send that many emails and then not get spammed or not get flagged with spam or anything like that. So that level of preparation is very often missing.
I fully agree in that. On our end, since we're doing ransomware incident response day to day, we're noticing exactly the same. So I feel like that even the bigger the company gets, the less they care about these things. Like obvious things like security awareness trainings, right? Which every company should have in place, like SMB, enterprise, doesn't matter. We see that all the time, that even bigger organizations are not really prepared and they should invest in these things. But of course, it's like paying an insurance, right? There is no direct benefit in doing these things or doing annual disaster recovery things. It's just stressing IT teams and all these things, but it's so crucial to do that upfront. Yeah, because most organizations out there are not really prepared about that. Yeah.
I totally agree with that. I think the difficult sell, so when we're asking someone to make an investment in security, is you're sort of saying to the organization, go and spend this money, and if it works, nothing will happen. You know, it's like you will have nothing to show for it. And when an organization is like, okay, well, how much can we spend on our marketing? You know, let's set the marketing budget. What happens if we do marketing well? Well, we sell more product and we make more money. But what happens if you do cybersecurity well? It's nothing. Ransomware, I think, is probably one of the most optimal examples of that, because how many ransomware incidents would be totally different if someone had reliable backups, for example, certainly from the—
Sounds easy, isn't it? Like,
yeah, I know it does.
It shouldn't be a problem. Yeah.
I was, telling stories. I was at a dentist here locally a few years ago, and I'm sitting in the dentist, and it's just like a dentist anywhere around the world. You know, it's just like there's staff at the front and dentists at the back, and, you know, maybe there's half a dozen people that work there. So it's a small business. And while I'm there, they're realizing that they've been ransomed, and they've got the IT guy in. And I kid you not, it's a true story. The IT guy comes in, he's looking at the systems, and he's like, okay. And I'm sitting reception watching this whole thing. I'm fascinated. And he's like, all right, where's your backups? Oh, yeah, we've got this backup server here. And he goes in the cupboard, he's looking, he's like, you know, it's not turned on, don't you? And then I'm in there getting my teeth done, and the dentists are talking about it to each other. And I'm just like, well, this is fascinating, because I'm seeing this play out in real time. And it was just a complete lack of preparation, and it was completely normal.
Exactly. This is exactly what we see in the field all the time. And it's concerning me. For example, if I'm going to a small company, let's say between 1 and 10 employees, I would say, okay, I understand they do not have the resources to put a proper IT in place, IT security especially. But if it goes to bigger companies, let's say 500 employees plus, I feel like some of these things should be obvious, but it's not reality. And even when we dealt with, like, of course, I can't disclosure a company name here. We had large corporations, and I've seen administrator passwords like Jessica without two-factor authentication on a domain administrator account. And I was like, what? You see such crazy things out there. But this is basic IT. This is nothing special, right? It's quite interesting. So these stressful situations, if someone like an IT professional works at a company or is an external IT service provider, do you maybe can share some tips from your end how the people can deal with these stressful situations, like personal practices? Do you have some tips on that end?
Well, I mean, the password being Jessica is such a perfect example of the level of sophistication that many organizations have. Very often I get asked this question about, you know, there'll be a data breach, and I've talked to someone from the media and they're like, could this be due to human error? It's like, well, of course it's due to human error. Like, every single incident is due to human error. There is never a time where we have a data breach and everyone goes, I don't know how that happened because we did everything right. It's like, no, Joey used the password of Jessica and someone then got in and then they're in Joey's account. So there's always a mistake that we make somewhere. And what I think is fascinating in many of these cases is, like you just said, a lack of 2FA and weak passwords. I mean, that's just the most basic things. And then, you know, we spoke about the backups. Well, you know, maybe not only is there no backups, but maybe no one's actually tried restoring, because, you know, backing up is one thing, actually restoring and getting successfully back online is a completely different thing. So, yeah, I think that so much of the advice that we see so frequently from people in the industry or governments as well, the Australian government's got a great resource they call the Essential Eight, which is just like sort of the fundamentals that every business should follow. And it's really, you look at it and you go, well, this is obvious and basic. And it is, but it's the stuff that organizations continually don't do.
And even if you have IT professionals in the company, what I feel like they sometimes missing training. Like, when we have a customer with an IT team of 10 plus people, so this is quite huge for an internal department. And what we're constantly seeing is that they are completely unprepared. But it's not a question of they do not want to gather some more information. It's more about they do not have the time to, because they packed with first level, second level tickets. So they have no room to grow and go into further education on their end. Do you also see that in the field? Like, that's a question of, like, the people do not have the time to do these things?
Yeah, and I think, again, that the question is, well, why don't they have the time? Because they're overburdened and understaffed. And it's because of things like we discussed just before, where very often things like security are seen as a cost with no immediate term benefit. There's certainly been a view of many organizations, and having been in that very, very large organization I just mentioned before, apologies if they're a customer, but one of the things that I would see there time and time again is the technology department in general, including the security folks, were viewed as a cost. So that this is a cost. We need to minimize the cost. The marketing people and sales people, different story. I mean, I remember one very specific example, and it's a little bit tangential, but it illustrates the mindset, where there'd be the Christmas party. And in the Christmas party, all the salespeople went to Hamilton Island, which is like a tropical island. We got to go to the local bowls club, and we had a budget of $20 each for drinks, you know, because we're the technology department.
So much.
I know. It's just great. Yeah, I mean, they were only worth, I think, I'm not sure how many billions of dollars Pfizer was worth at the time. They're one of the world's largest companies. Yeah. But yeah, as we know, very often it's in the larger companies where it's difficult to get money out of them. So unfortunately, that this is an organizational deficiency in many cases. But the funny thing about it, and I'm sure you see this with ransomware as well, but it's the same with data breaches, where after an incident like this happens, organizations will spend any amount of money to try and get themselves out of it. It's like, just take my money and help me. Yes. And this is not something I do either, by the way, but clearly organizations just want to throw money at the problem to make it go away. But it's only when it's actually a problem that manifests itself. And of course, we know that it could be so much more efficiently handled by doing it right in the first place.
Absolutely. So especially decisions makers need to reflect on these topics, but they usually don't do that.
Yeah, totally. Right.
So which brings me back to the question I've asked in between. Do you want to share some personal practices on how to deal with stressful situations that could be like meditation, especially for IT teams out there? Like, yeah, you got the point, right?
Well, is the question like, what do I do to try and relax? Okay, oh, well, that's a good question. So part of the reason I was rushing for this interview is I just went wakeboarding. So I rushed home. I found a t-shirt because I wasn't even wearing anything. And I did my hair really, really quickly. But that's, that's one of the things that works for me. And in fact, it's interesting because I have gone through some really stressful things for a few years there, which I've written about very publicly as well. And I was trying to find what are the things that help me relax. And my wife was like, you should try yoga. So I went to yoga and I hated it so bad. I really, really hated it. She's like, you should try meditation. She's like, no, I can't. I think about too much. So I think the observation there is that it's definitely a very personal thing. And she does things that work really, really well for her. What works really well for me is things where I have to focus. And if I don't focus, something bad happens. So yeah, when I go out to the wakeboard park, it's like, if I don't focus and I crash, it's going to hurt. I was very into motorsport for a while there. And it's the same thing. It's like, if you don't pay attention, something really, really bad is going to happen. Or I'll go out on my push bike and I'll ride as fast as I can. Or I'll go out on the jet ski or one of those things, because I find that I need a distraction for my brain in order to relax. And if it's not distracted, it's going to be thinking about everything, the good stuff, the bad stuff. It will just be all over the place.
So you're more on the activity side of things, basically. But yeah, I fully agree in that. I'm also doing wakeboarding, so I know what you mean. Like, nice. You can't be unconcentrated, right? Otherwise, yeah. You're going to have a problem with wake. And but that way, this is a good way to relax. For me, meditation works quite well. And sometimes a little bit noisy in your head, but like what I see in the field is when I have to use the MSP in Germany, that the most technicians struggle with really calming down because they're coming back from work. They probably are sitting down, open up Steam, play a game, right? So they're constantly coming back to the computer. They jumping into the ticket system, answering questions. And even if it's leisure time, basically, but this is what I realized, like we have a clear internal rule when the people have to stop work and really calm down. Yeah. Otherwise, this is not really beneficial for you.
Yeah, I think just being able to soothe your mind, and again, I appreciate it's different for people. And honestly, I'm envious that meditation works for you. I think if I could make it work, I'd maybe be a lot more relaxed. There's a little bit of me as well, which is always sort of thinking about what is like the highest and best use of my time. You know, how can I be as optimal as I possibly can? And one of the things that sort of dawned on me, and I just thought it's because you mentioned gaming, is many years ago, I completely stopped gaming because I could just see hours disappear. And I just remember this is when I was living in Sydney, and I'd go upstairs, and it was before kids or anything like that, so I had more time, and I'd be there gaming for hours. And not only would hours disappear, but it'd make me angry, because I'd play like first-person shooters and things like that, and if I was losing, it's like, yeah, I just wasn't happy. So getting rid of that was actually good for me.
I can feel you 100%. So when I was a little bit younger, I used to play a lot of Counter-Strike. And it's just scary if you look at like your time count that you spend like thousand hours into this, and it's nice for a moment, but of course this is distracting. And but yeah, I'm gonna take that with me because I'm still gaming nowadays, so it's a good tip.
It is also leisure, and it people might find that that's a bit of an outlet for them as well. So I'm reticent to say that it's a bad thing, but I just found for me, particularly when I was starting to get interested in other things that were more productive in my life, it just sort of going cold turkey on it was good for me.
Sounds great. So let's jump to the Have I Been Pawned section. You've launched an amazing website, Have I Been Pawned. I'm sure that website is known to the people of that audience. Can you share with us one of the key takeaways on your journey since launching the website?
I think my key takeaway, to just think of the first thing that came to my head, but I think it's quite pertinent, is that we cannot trust organizations to do the right thing. And I sort of hate the fact that Have I Been Pwned exists, because imagine if you didn't need to, I'm not saying, stop all the data breaches, like that would be great as a society if we stopped that. But imagine if every time there was a data breach, an organization knew about it quickly and they responded and they let everyone know and they communicated transparently and they looked after people and they were nice about it. You know, imagine if they did all of these things. But what I sort of hate about this society more than I was going to say industry, but it's not even an industry thing, is that there's just so much, frankly, it's so much ass covering from organizations a lot of the time where they just do not want to acknowledge what has happened or the impact or do the right thing by individuals. Without naming the company, I've got a long thread going at the moment from an organization that had 16 million records exposed. And they're a service provider used by other organizations. So there's 16 million people. In fact, there's a lot more than 16 million records. There's 16 million people, and many of them had different records from different transactions. But these people did not know this organization because they'd gone shopping somewhere to buy a t-shirt, and then that service used the one that was now breached. So Have I Been Pwned sent, I think, 130,000 emails to subscribers. And it went, hey, you've been pwned. This is what it is. Here's the explanation. And everyone's like, well, they never let us know. I couldn't get in touch with them. I couldn't get a response. And I keep adding to this thread. Finally, today, the first time I've seen this company actually responded. And the disclosure was terrible. It was absolutely terrible. But at least we got them to that point. And I lament the fact that Have I Been Pwned needs to still exist to get organizations like that to at the very least disclose. And I just get to the point, I wrote this blog post about the five stages of data breach grief. It's like the, you know, the five stages of grief if you've lost someone, you know, it's like anger and denial and everything. And that the reason I wrote it is sort of telling the story of eventually you will have to deal with it and accept it as an organization. If you've had a data breach, you might be angry about it and then denying, then you might try and bargain your way out of it, but you will have to deal with it. So I shared that for this particular organization in the tweet thread. It's like, look, they're going through this. They will have to deal with it. I'm going to make sure they have to deal with it because I'm being very public about it. So it's unfortunate that we still need Have I Been Pwned just to get people to do the right thing.
I can also imagine that you're quite proud of that, right? Since this is creating instant value for a ton of people.
Well, I think I'm proud of the fact that it's filling a hole that needs to be filled. It's still a hole that I do genuinely wish wasn't there because it's a sucky situation for people. But yeah, I've made something that is actually genuinely useful, and I never expected it to be. I never tried. It just just kind of worked out.
That's wrong, right?
which is nice. But yeah. Look, I'm definitely proud of the service.
That's actually great. On the ransomware side of things, just a small insight from our end is that we normally, if you communicate with the victims on the company management board, we clearly tell them, listen, the best way to handle these things is transparent. And that means you need to inform your customers and you need to inform your employees about that thing. That's always the best approach. But the reality is a lot of these companies are actually trying to hide that. So they might do like a soft GDPR reporting about like, okay, it happened, but it's not clear if they have access data. And so they sneak around that thing, especially in Europe. And I feel sad about that because that way you can be sure that the cyber attackers, especially groups like Lockbit or R-Evil, which are still very active groups out there, they steal data, they publish it on the block on their end. We see this all the time. And we sometimes see that like 50, 60, 70,000 people are accessing the block. And you can be sure that they grab the data dump and use it later on for evil purposes.
Yep.
And this just makes me sad. That's the same thing what you just said about Have I Been Pwned, right? So it's more about informing the customers in the end because the companies won't do that, especially if they're bigger, right? Yeah.
I had one data breach comes to mind without naming which one it is, but a friend of mine worked in a security position for this company, very, very large company. And I had actually disclosed through him, and it was taking a long time to get any sort of statement from them. When I say a long time, I think it was about like 11 days or something. And it was one of my closest friends. I sort of said to the guy, I was like, what is going on? And he's like, mate, it's a room full of lawyers standing around figuring out how to spin it. Like that's what it is. And look, I guess ultimately firms, boards are accountable to shareholders. Their imperatives are around maintaining the reputation and the value of the company and whatnot. But it just seems to be that very frequently that is done at the expense of the customers. That just feels very, very wrong. But it's also fascinating when you look at the amount of leverage that I can get out of Haverbanpana. I mean, it's an enormous platform. It's so well known. It's so well supported and recognized and trusted that if an organization isn't doing the right thing, I'd certainly never threaten anyone outright, but I'm having private discussions with these companies going, look, you've had a breach. You've got, let's say 20 million people out there. A lot of them are going to be my subscribers. I've got a little counter here on my desk. There's about 4.5 million Haverbanpana subscribers. So there's always some of them in a data breach. And I'll say to them, I have a duty of care to my subscribers. You know, they don't pay me any money, but I feel obligated, I want to let them know that this has happened. So I'm going to let them know. What would you like me to tell them? And then obviously they know that if I go and send 100,000 emails to people, it's public, right? It's in the press. They're going to get news about it. So I actually like having that leverage to compel organizations to do the right thing, whether they like it or not.
Fully agree on that. Let's see how that works out in reality in the next years, right? But especially if you look at the ransomware, the tactics with the cyber attackers are using, which we're seeing day to day, they are evolving. Like first you had just the simple data encryption, which was like the first layer of extortion. Mm-hmm. Nowadays we have the second layer, which is mostly publishing the data on the blog. But especially with bigger groups like Black Hat, Black Matter, and so on, they now adding a third level. That could be a DDoS attack, which is, depending on the company, could be a thing or not. But the more interesting thing is that they start to reach out to the customers of the victim. So sending them emails like, hey, listen, we have stolen data from your company over that channel, and you should contact the company behind that. And they calling customers. So they're not trying to hide anymore. They're quite rude in what they're doing. And this is just, I'm curious where this goes. Right, they're gonna evolve over time, so they're gonna add more and more layers, and at one point the company can't hide anymore. Nowadays it's already a problem, but the groups are smart, the cyber attackers, what we see in the field.
I think it's really interesting to look at it very much through a business lens. So imagine something like Vastaamo, right? So for anyone who hasn't heard about Vastaamo before, the Finnish psychotherapy service a couple of years ago got ransomed, didn't pay the ransom, so they just went and ransomed the individuals. And that was sort of horrendous insofar as it was vulnerable people with psychotherapy notes, which are the most personal sort of thing that you could have, and they're getting ransomed not to leak it. And of course, it did all get leaked eventually anyway, and that's in Haverbanpana. But if you look at it through the business lens, and you say illegally obtained data, I don't like saying stolen because stolen always feels a little bit weird. You know, as well, did you steal it? Yeah. Well, but do they still have it? Yeah, they've still got it as well. Well, if someone steals your bike, you don't have a bike anymore. to me, it's okay. You've taken a lot of copies of it. Regardless, it's illegally obtained. If you look at it as a commodity, and you say, "What is the highest and best use of this commodity? What is the most valuable thing we can do?" And we just put all of our moral judgment aside for a moment. It's like, well, yeah, you're going to try and obviously ask the company for money in order to get it back. But it does have value well beyond just the value to the company. It has value to the individuals. So, of course it makes sense to go after the individuals. And it doesn't matter if it's psychotherapy notes, or we had a very, very prominent one here in Australia only a few months ago, Medibank, the private healthcare insurer. They just started dumping lists of people who had abortions. You know, pay us money or we're going to dump that. And then it was lists of people who were having psychotherapy treatment or drug and alcohol treatment or... And it was, you look at it and you go, it's almost hard to explain how unfathomably evil that is. But as a business, it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. Also, what we see are that they are quite good organized, depending on the group, of course. If it's not a classical ransom versus service concept like Lockbit used to be, more like the concentrated groups like Black Hat, which operates mostly out of their own home base. And so they do not deal a lot with affiliate partners. And if you go that route, you see that they're really sophisticated in what they're doing, but they are also organized. For example, sometimes when we're doing the professional ransom negotiations for our customers, we chat with them, of course, and depending on the situation, they sometimes tell you some personal information, like where they live, I'm not sure if this is the reality, right? But one guy once told us, like, he's living in Thailand and he grows some chicken and enjoying the life and so on. It's like sharing some personal things. And whenever we pick something like this up, we forward this to the law enforcement. But of course, you can't always catch these things. Like when we had a very deep talk with one of the police leaders in Germany, which is Lars Huwald, he's leading the LKA in Germany. And he once told us that like 95% of the reportings go to nowhere. So they drop the law enforcement because the IP address is coming from Russia, coming from North Korea, doesn't matter, maybe over VPN, you don't know, right? But they are limited, their capabilities to hunt these guys down. He also told me sometimes they know who that person is, like a guy sitting in Egypt, and he cashed out at one point over a Bitcoin exchange, for example. But the problem is it's sometimes not worth the effort to follow up these small affiliate partners, like they demanding like $5,000 to $10,000. It's not worth to go the legal route, so they'd rob it. So it's a very weird thing. And I do not feel like that ransomware going to go anywhere soon. It's going to be there. What is your opinion about that? Do you think how that ransomware going to change the next years?
Well, yeah, I think one of the things that a lot of people don't realize about ransomware is just how far back it goes. I mean, we're talking like literally the 80s and the AIDS Trojan, and you get a floppy disk in the mail and then you have to send a cashier's check to Panama. So yeah, we are more than three decades into this. And I think that we sort of got a lot of mainstream recognition of ransomware, probably particularly, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago, when so many people would get hit as individuals and suddenly it became a big news thing. And it would happen on the internet, and it would happen because you downloaded something you shouldn't have, or you got an email with an attachment. But it has come so far from there, and it has evolved so much since that point. And, you know, you just made the point that so much of it now is not just attacks against availability. It's not just encrypted data. It is actually attacks against confidentiality too, with the dumping of it. I think that with a theme that's come up here a little bit between myself saying, you know, what's the highest and best use of the data, and then you making the point that a lot of these organizations are very, very well organized and well-structured, it does feel like it's becoming more business-like. And I guess like any other business, they're going to evolve and adapt to the environment. There'll be risks around them, but there'll also be other opportunities. So I wonder, particularly given the geopolitics at the moment, how much more well-protected certain parts of the world are for criminals that operate out of there. You can all sort of join the dots on what I mean by that. So yeah, perhaps they might become a little bit more brazen. I think it's fascinating that we keep coming up with better ways of protecting against any sorts of online threat. And like any sort of attacker defender sort of model, they then come up with something else. So it keeps it entertaining, doesn't it? But I think it also makes it very hard to predict exactly where it will go. Other than I'm pretty confident it's just more business-like, more ways of monetizing the ill-gotten gains.
Yeah. And also the stolen confidential data, right? The data dumps that we're going to see in the next years for sure.
Yeah.
Right. True. So especially when we talk about that topic, we have talked about your workshop before. Is there something where IT professionals can profit in if they take one of your workshops? Is there something in, especially for day-to-day cybersecurity, where they can gather some benefits out of this? Could you tell us if someone participate in one of these workshops? Maybe you can explain a little bit how targeted they are.
Yeah, so there's a workshops link on my blog, and that lists all the topics. And they're topics that evolve over the course of time. I mean, I'm sort of 8 years into doing these now, so that they've had to adapt a little bit. For example, there's a module on TLS. And TLS has really, really changed. You know, we've gone away from the secure text and it being a rare thing to have TLS to having ubiquitously free certificates and trying to get completely away from the whole idea of positive visual indicators. So stuff evolves over time. Generally, we run the same set of modules, but depending on the organizations and the demographics within there, we might target it a little bit differently. For example, Scott's doing one in the US shortly, and it's two back-to-back for the same organization. But we might try and sort of push a little bit more of it more towards the more security-orientated people and then a little bit more towards the developer-orientated people. But one of the nice things about the workshops and one of the things I say at the very start of it is an interactive experience. So you come and you ask questions and you say, look, this is what's important for us in our organization, or we built this system that does this or that. What do you think? Yeah, if you just want to listen to Scott or I talk at you, well, there's, I think I've got 46 Pluralsight courses or something. You can sit there and just listen to it over and over again. So that the value and the benefit for organizations is the engagement and the interaction.
What is the average requirement to participate in one of these trainings? Do you need to be like an IT professional already, or do you can join in as a trainee? Like, where is like the target audience for these trainings?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. So one of the things that I was conscious of when I designed this workshop originally, I'd done other workshops where sometimes there were some bits and pieces of them that were good, and then there were other bits and pieces of them that weren't as good. So if, for example, I remember one workshop that was excellent, but it took about 2 hours to get virtual machines set up because we had to have just this precise image in order to make it work. So we use a publicly accessible website. It's like literally hack-yourself-first.com. Sorry, there's no setup process, which is great. And then in terms of the modules, so we run 8 modules on each day, we wanted to get away from them being interdependent on each other so that if someone, let's say someone really can't write JavaScript. So, okay, fine. There's one module where you have to write a bit of JavaScript. If you can't do that, you go on to the next thing. Or if you can't write any TSQL, you know, that's fine. You just go to the next one. The demographics we get are quite varied. They're predominantly developers and security pros. But one of the demographics we get a bit of is testers, which is cool because testers are not necessarily people who write code. And when there are exos that write code, we try and pair people. So it's like, you're a tester, you're a developer. All right, you guys are going to get together for couple of these modules. There's been a bunch of project managers. On one occasion, it was a CEO of a company. He's like, I just want to figure out what this stuff's about. All right, that's good. And you know, there's such a breadth of material in there. It is not a very deeply technical thing that never gets out of the weeds. You know, I mean, the example I just gave, things like TLS are a great example. Everyone has seen the padlock in the browser. What does it mean? What do you think it means? What do you think the certificate authorities are selling you these certificates based on? Enumeration vectors, you know, notice how you go into a password reset and it tells you if the email address exists or not. What does it mean from a privacy perspective? How can we design around that? So there's lots of stuff in there that is relevant regardless of people's technical capacity. I'm excited talking about it, actually. I should do more of these. I need to travel again.
No, I think especially now for our audience, that could be a thing. So if you're listening to that, make sure that you check the description of that recording later on. So we're going to link everything to Troy about these things so that you can check it out yourself and give it a shot. And like always with learning and average, what I feel like is it's important to get started. There's never going to be like the perfect moment to do something like this. And might that be a chance for someone out there? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Troy, thank you very much for this. Now having one more personal question. I don't know if you're familiar with the Japanese concept of ikigai. It means, rawly translated, what is the reason to get up in the morning? What is your ikigai?
I think I sort of touched on it before. I said, look, I don't know what I'm going to do each day. I genuinely don't, other than, you know, like we had this in the calendar. That's good because I've got something that I have to commit to then. But I genuinely just don't know what's going to happen each day. And I get up very early and I sit out the back where it's nice and peaceful and watch the sun come up and have a coffee. And I try and make sure I don't look at my phone or my iPad or anything until I've got my coffee and I'm comfortable, because I know that I'm going to open it up and there's going to be something I just didn't expect. And it's usually things that are really interesting. You know, there'll be some data breach I never saw coming, or someone's turned around and said, hey, here's 200 million new records for Have I Been Pwned, or someone's wanting me to do a talk or to go somewhere interesting. I'm going somewhere I've never been later this year. And that just popped up out of nowhere. So, okay, cool. I'd actually like to go to that place. So I like the uncertainty of what I'm going to find each day. I know it's going to be something that's going to be exciting and interesting, but I never know what it's going to be.
Thank you for this. I fully agree on the do not touch your smart phone before the day starts thing. This is a really bad thing if you have that kind of addiction. I used to have that, but there's a very great feature from Apple on the iPhone, which is called digital well-being. And also a very good tip to the audience, just set your limits to social media to 50 minutes a day and you're set. This is brilliant. Very easy to get rid of that.
I do too much work on Twitter. That's my problem. It's like, I'm stuck on something. How do I do this? And I just,
yeah. You're deep into the rabbit hole then.
Yes, I know. I'm conscious of it.
What book do you think everyone should read?
I published a book late last year. Now, I'm going to give you a self-ingratiating answer in part because I think possibly one of my failings is I don't read a lot of books. I've just not got the attention span. I end up consuming lots of small pieces of information. So I don't really have something good I can recommend, but in part also because I was really excited to get the book done. So I published a book in conjunction with another friend of mine who's done a lot of publishing. And it's a collection of different blog posts from the last, since forever, 13 a bit years, and the stories that were behind them. Because he sort of came to me one day and he's like, you write a lot of really interesting blog posts, but I think there's more to it. I think there's something behind this. And then I think something else happened afterwards, like put those stories out there. So we made this book. It's called Pwned. It's at book.troyhunt.com. And it's all digital. You can buy it online. And it's all the backstories. And the feedback from that has been awesome. For me, it was very much a passionate project because I just wanted to get these other stories out there. I'm not going to retire on it, but I'm really happy it's out there.
It reminds me a little bit of Tim Ferriss. He actually did the same with his podcast. At one point, he came up with the idea to gather the podcast content and create a new book called Tools of Titans, which is brilliant. But it's the same thing. So he gathered very, very, very good content and moved it to a format where people can easily consume that. And I really enjoy something like this. So is there also like a paperback version of the book or is it only digital available?
It's only digital at the moment. I sort of thought about doing paperback because, sometimes it's nice to hand people something at an event or something, but also books are really big. I'm traveling to the other side of the world. I'm pretty limited with the amount of stuff. I guess you could get them shipped to the event, but then that sounds like a lot of hard work too. Look, I figure particularly for my demographic, everyone is able to get this stuff digitally if they want to.
Yeah.
Maybe I need to turn it into an audio book or something sometime as well. That could be fun.
Especially IT professional. They have not a problem at all to get it as a PDF and read it on Kindle or something like this.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, great. So what's up and coming from your side that we should keep an eye out for?
Well, I think the big thing I'm sort of focusing on at the moment is just a little bit of the macro picture is how do I make Have I Been Pwned succeed me? So, what it's like, you go wakeboarding, maybe you're not going to come back one day. We got sharks as well, right? Like it's not just the wakeboard. Now, what happens to Have I Been Pwned if I get into an unexpected wakeboard shark related accident and I can't run the thing anymore? So the sort of succession planning for it is something that is on my mind a lot lately. And many people know I went through a fortunately failed merger and acquisition process in 2019. And there are all sorts of reasons why it was very fortunate it didn't work out, and all sorts of reasons why I think I went through it in the first place that became clear later on. But part of the goal there was to find a home for it where it could sustain and grow and outlive me. Now, I don't think that's the right approach anymore for all sorts of reasons. But I do think that it needs to be a more self-sustaining entity. It needs to have other people that work for it. It needs to be able to pay for other people that work for it. It needs to have the right support. So that's something I'm putting a lot of thought into at the moment. And my hope is over the course of this year, people start to see more things that sort of lead us in that direction. And then also give us the ability to do more stuff. One of the things I really want to do is get more data processed. There's so much data that I already have that is not in Have I Been Pwned because it's hard and time consuming, especially disclosure. So I need to work more on that. But also, whilst it remains a passion project and something that really just my wife and I work on, I can do as much or as little of it as I want as well. So some days I go wakeboarding and not much happens on it.
Can imagine that since you're having a very great network, if you come to that point, it's quite easy to gather very good people to your business, right? So over the network, there are a ton of very good people out there, maybe also within your audience, right? Which are IT professionals which can help with these things. So maybe if someone listens to that and feels like, hey, that could be a thing to reach out to Troy and help him with his challenges, feel free to do that. Spam his email inbox. It's not a problem.
The trick there is getting the right help that reduces your workload. And I'm sure you have to go through this running a business as well, but very often it is an increase of effort in order to try and bring other people on board. Now, a bit of a balance I've found with that is there is a part of Have I Been Pwned that's Pwned passwords. So it's a password aggregation that people can use to block known bad passwords. So I just open sourced all of that. And then I had one person in particular, a friend of mine from Iceland called Stefan, who travels in similar circles, is another Microsoft MVP, speaks at events, and he's sort of taken up the baton, if you like, and been responsible for coordinating the community. So that was a good example where it made sense. But, you know, ultimately, if I need people to spend more time on, you know, have I been pwned as a whole, then it's something where, well, unfortunately, you also have to pay people to have sort of coordinated work as well. So that's something that I think we'll keep working towards this year.
Sounds great. I'm looking forward to this. Well, Troy, do you want to add something from your end, which we have not talked about yet?
I think we've covered a lot there. I just hope it's been interesting and useful. I'm obviously passionate about the industry and about data breaches and have been paying everything. And I just hope people find that same sort of passion and get enjoyment out of it. It's a little bit like that saying of when you love what you do for your job, you never work a day in your life. So yeah, may you also find the same happiness in your jobs.
Really appreciate that you have spent the time today to share some insights. And yeah, it was absolutely brilliant also for me to get you known better and get a deeper understanding. And for the people in the audience, if you would like to get a deeper insight about Troy, we're going to link everything in the description. Make sure to click the link, follow to his website, check out his new book if you have some time. But of course, in overall, there are a lot of workshops out there where you could probably benefit in. Troy, thank you very much. I appreciate it. It was absolutely amazing today.
Cool. Thanks for having me.